Accession number 27185, reel 54.
Major Barras, reel 54. I think you were saying your parades all passed off.
Yeah, they all passed off very well. In fact, we got very well supported by the local population who came in their droves. I mean, they loved that sort of thing. I was just about to say that it was about this time, I think, that we got a visit by the president of Nicaragua. He hadn't come to see us, he'd come to see the local government and the governor. But we were involved. His visit was to do with a row which had been brewing between HMG and Nicaragua over the rights of turtle fishing in the waters between Jamaica and Central America. And we had to provide a guard of honor for him, but being a president, he got the full Monty, so to speak. But we had a problem with the national anthem, their national anthem, of course, that nobody knew it. So he didn't get a guard. I can't remember how it worked, actually. I don't think he got a guard of honor when he first arrived, and I think we worked it that way, so he didn't. But in order to get the national anthem, the bandmaster of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers sat down with some cronies of the president, his bodyguard, in fact. He surrounded by men with bulging jackets with weapons underneath. But they also had a little band. Formed themselves into a little band of banjos and guitars and things. And one evening they sat down with the bandmaster, and they played the Nicaraguan national anthem, whilst the bandmaster orchestrated it for his band. And the next day, or whenever it was, Guard of Honor came out, and there was the Royal Welsh Fusiliers band playing the national anthem of Nicaragua.
Was this President Somoza?
I can't remember who it was. I remember Somoza's name. I mean, he was an outrageous man, wasn't he?
Was a whole family of them.
Yes, yeah. No, it was well before then, I think. Well, of course, it might have been. But then there weren't the troubles in Central America then. I mean, it was fairly peaceful. I mean, apart from Guatemala sort of saber rattling across the border by British Guiana, I can't remember. There weren't any upheavals so much in those days. They came later, I think. Of course, the other thing that happened in June was the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, had his massive stroke. When he was having dinner in Downing Street with the Italian Prime Minister. And as a result of that, arrangements were postponed for a guard of honour, a band and drums of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and a disappointed goat to go to Bermuda for a meeting with President Eisenhower. And of course the Guard of Honour was going there for Eisenhower, not Churchill, so it would have been a full guard. So that was postponed. It was all put on again six months later when Churchill totally recovered. But I seem to remember that even after this great big massive stroke he had, 6 weeks later he was reported as being Doncaster races. That was 6 weeks after he'd had it. So I think most men have been still on their backs. I mean, the terrific constitution. I also had another visit to the Americans about this time to Puerto Rico on this occasion, one of the routine meetings with the Americans. I also visited Dominica and Montserrat, which Montserrat was in the news in the recent years with its volcano eruption. Lovely little island. They had a local, I suppose, I don't know whether he was a Montserrati or Montserratian or whatever they call them, but he was certainly Caribbean commissioner there, as they called him, in charge. He lived in a administrator's house, which could have been a sort of country house in England, with rose gardens and everything. It was lovely little island. It's such a shame what's happened to it.
Did it have any sort of military presence?
No, nothing at all. They're just, I don't think they had a European there at all. I think the whole thing was run by
the locals.
Yeah, by locals. But, of course, Dominica is a different kettle of fish altogether. It was a big, rugged island which has been, to some extent, unexplored. It wasn't a tourist destination in those days. There weren't very many tourists anywhere in those days. I mean, rich people from England used to come out and spend the winter there, and you've got some Americans coming to Jamaica, but by and large, the tourism had hardly started. But I remember in Dominica, I stayed in the Kensington Hotel, it was called. It was an old wooded edifice in a sort of high street, I suppose you'd call it, which sort of run little shops and goats running up and down the middle of the road. And in the evening, I went into the dining room. I was the only person there, and it was getting dark. And waitress came and stood by me and asked me what I'd like to have. And I'd been pre-warned about this before. And she said, "You like the mountain chicken?" So I said, "No, thanks very much." I said, "So are you afraid of the mountain chicken?" She said, "And of course, the mountain chickens are frogs." I always remember her saying, "Are you afraid of them?" And it was dark and pretty spooky, actually, at that time. I was standing over, and I was empty in this empty, darkening room. Anyway, I didn't have mountain chicken. I think I had sort of ones that run around on their feet on the ground.
Again, was there anything there to inspect in a military way?
No, I don't think so. I was purely there to see the administrator. Of course, all these islands, there are only governors in Grenada and Trinidad. Down there, the Windward and the Leeward Islands, and all the other little islands between had administrators which came under the main governor. So, as far as Dominica was concerned, they had nothing, I don't think. I think they had a commissioner of police who was British, but I can't remember. A lot of these places used to run themselves. Then we had a change of AQMG about this time. Laurie Sheldon, who was a nice, efficient and easygoing lieutenant colonel, who was really a very nice chap from the Devonshire Regiment, I remember. He was never really conscious of his rank at all, but he was very efficient. He got jobs done, and he was replaced by a Colonel Atkinson, who was rather different. He was a bit more buttoned up, so to speak, and wasn't so outgoing. So we all had to change our way of dealing with.
Did things become more formal?
Okay, he was a bit more formal. He didn't let himself out so much as Laurie Sheldon. Laurie Sheldon, you could talk to her all the time on anything, but he was monosyllabic sort of attitude. But he was good at his job, and I think he got on quite well with the brigadier, and we all got on well enough with him. But of course, we've been used to. It was rather like going back to the second Essex when we changed from Geoffrey Elliott to the next CO,
yes.
Who was entirely different. So we got the same situation here, although it wasn't so important as it was in the Essex days. then in August, I achieved 34 years of life on Mother Earth that time. And then, whilst we were all sitting back, thinking how we could now relax and just pass paper over the desk and go out and do some inspections, our lives were shattered by a flash signal that came from the War Office. And it only took 30 minutes, which in those days was an absolute miracle, to get from the War Office to the Brigadier's desk. Well, no, to the cipher section. It had to be deciphered and then sent into the Brigadier's office, who read it, and then he called in the AQMG and myself and said that this is a signal from the War Office, they are about to suspend the constitution of British Guiana.
Oh. What was going on there?
And we have to be prepared to send troops. Well, the problem there was that the first minister was Chetty Jagan. Now, the politics there were Indian on one side and local African, Caribbean Africans on the other. There were two parties there. There was the People's Progressive Party, which was Chetty Jagan's, who was the Indian. He had an American wife who was no doubt prodding him in the back. And then there was the other side, which were all Africans. But at this time, the Indians were in power. Chetty Jagan was in power as the chief minister. His party was in power. And he'd been, for some time now, he'd been going to Moscow, he'd been visiting Iron Curtain countries, he'd been making efforts to undermine the police and the volunteers. He'd been forming all kinds of what you might call socialist committees. The Pioneer Youth, which was a communist-inspired organization. He had a peace committee, and then he had what he called he tried to form the People's Police. Now, this we knew about him, and the governor, who at that time was Sir Somebody Savage, I think, can't remember his real name, his first name, was well aware this was going on. Of course, he couldn't stop him from going to Moscow or going outside the country. And I think he'd been finding it a bit difficult to prove that, in fact, he was undermining the Constitution. But, of course, he had been, and I find it a bit difficult looking at this stage that he hadn't been caught up earlier.
I was going to say, you don't seem to have had any premonition from what you're saying.
Well, I think, it was known what was going on, and I think the governor thought he could handle it.
But it hadn't come to your notice before.
Oh, yes, we knew that. We knew through Felix, our tame MI chap, what was going on there. I visited British Guiana earlier and talked to the governor and the chief of police or the commissioner of police down there. And we were aware that he was communist. Mm. But I think his activities really hadn't been appreciated as being so dangerous, because if he succeeded in carrying on as he did, his aim was to turn British Guiana into a communist state.
Was there anything he had done which had finally tipped the balance so that you got this flash?
I think he called a strike. He called a strike for the sugar community, and they all came out on strike. I don't honestly think that most of the people who had put him in power, that is all the Indians, they only voted for him because he was an Indian. And I don't think they really wanted to serve in a communist state, and I don't think they agreed with his politics, most of them. In fact, they probably weren't aware of what was going on. So the situation sort of boiled up to the point where the British government suspended the constitution. But the first thing they wanted to do was to get troops in there before they did it. Another piece of paper, which shows the document, which was an actual fact sent out by the government. After we'd arrived there in October, which starts off, Her Majesty's government has decided that the constitution of British Guiana must be suspended to prevent communist subversion of the government and a dangerous crisis both in public order and in economic affairs. That was read out, that is what the government said. The governor then himself broadcast this and then made a statement of his own. But this wasn't made public, this wasn't sent out,
yes,
until the troops were there, and that was the 9th of October.
Yeah.
So what
day did the flash signal arrive?
Well, it must have been sometime in September,
yes,
because a lot had to be done. Mm-hmm.
Was there a garrison in British Guiana on a permanent basis?
No.
So no troops there at
all? No.
Was there any sort of local militia force?
There was a volunteer force, yes, which he was trying to subvert.
Had he managed to infiltrate?
I think he is having problems with it. I think he was gay. He wouldn't have done with the volunteers, I don't think, because they were joined as volunteers and they were loyal to the Crown.
So they joined the volunteers for the right sort of motive.
Well, that's right. I think he had more. He was beginning to have more luck with some of the police on the fringes.
Did you have any evidence that he had started to create any sort of armed organisation of his own as part of his pioneer youth movement?
No, we didn't. As you see later, there was a question of gun running over the border from Brazil, but I don't think so. I don't think we ever found any arms there. I think he was just trying to do it all by subversion, because his attitude was, well, we're all locals. If I can get them on my side against the European or the UK government, who are all Westerners anyway, and outsiders, then I'm home and dried. He found it easier to do it that way than to have an armed uprising. But, of course, he didn't. But, I mean, he was getting quite dangerous. He could have been quite dangerous. The funny thing is, of course, that although he was deposed, he eventually came back again later, but changed a changed man. He wasn't sort of firebrand that he was in those days.
So you got the flash signal, and your instructions were to arrange to put troops into.
Yes. So what?
Did the signal specify a timetable, or did it?
No, it said that the. I think it more or less said they wanted a battalion group down there.
Yes.
Which would be moved there by ships of the West Indies station. Mm. In other words, a cruiser, and I think it specified the cruiser Sheffield and two frigates, and that some aircraft could be chartered from British West Indian Airways.
Did it give you a timetable?
No, I don't think so. It all depended on really where the ships were and how long it would take to get them back. Of course, they got their orders through the Admiralty to return to Jamaica, or not return, but to come to Jamaica. Now, I don't know where they were at that time. I mean, the Sheffield was probably some distance away. And had a sort of week or more to get there, which in fact it did, because it only just got there as I got back. And what happened was that the brig and I we wanted to know more about what was going on down there before we sent troops in. You can't just sort of send them in. It's not a sort of hostile landing on a beach.
Presumably you weren't planning to do an assault landing.
No, nothing like that. So we had to find out how we could do it and then get the troops in as quickly as possible, deployed before anybody knew what was going on. So what happened was the brig said, right, we'll go down to Trinidad, and it was arranged between himself and the governor that the commissioner of police and his secretary, the governor's secretary, who in fact was an executive secretary, not just a sort of bloke who sat there typing, would meet us in Trinidad. Now, we also took Felix, our spy, and we had to go in civilian clothes, of course, as civilians. So the brigger and I got into the flew down there wearing what was called Tower Isle shirts, and these days, I mean, they're just the flowery ones, you know. But it was very difficult because we were supposed to be tourists. Now, respect for rank is very deep in the British Army, and I could hardly go around calling him Uncle Fred. So I had to be very careful of how I talked to him in public.
Wouldn't your bearing and haircuts and general appearance rather give you away?
No, I think most people had short haircuts in those days. I don't know whether we made a point of stooping or whatever. We didn't sit together, we sat in different parts of the aircraft. Anyway, when we got to Trinidad, we went into the Bel Air Hotel, I remember, which we booked a room. And there we met up with the Commissioner of Police and the Secretary. And it was just an ordinary bedroom. We just all sat around on the beds and chairs. I remember we produced a bottle of scotch and we drank out of tooth mugs and glasses. And they filled us in on what was going on there. There was nothing much more they could tell us about the situation. And then the brig said, well, we ought to have somebody in there to find out what it's like before we sent the troops in, and somebody from the army. And I didn't like the way he kept on looking across the table at me as he was saying it, and of course it was me that had to go. So I was ordered to dress myself up as a civilian again. We went back to Jamaica, and there I found Felix had got me a false passport. I mean, all the details about me were correct except the name. And he'd chosen Paul Barlow, which was my pseudonym. He'd known PB, like Patrick Barris, so in case I forgot who I was. So I was armed with this false passport. I had to make sure I got nothing on me, which no regimental ties, nothing on me which would show that I was army. And that I would go down there as a civil airline aircraft engineer and to visit the British Guiana Airways and stay with the owner of British Guiana Airways.
Presumably he'd been squared in a bond.
Well, he must have been. He must have known. I think he must have known. Yeah, he knew what was going on. It was quite a character. He was American. He was well into his 60s, I suppose. He was a cantankerous, irascible, argumentative, self-opinionated Midwest American, but he'd done a lot there in opening up the country to the air by establishing bases around the place and airports or airfields where he could land. He had a small fleet of Grumman aircraft, water, not seaplanes, what's the word I want?
Flying boats,
that's right, with the one engine up in the above the cockpit.
Were these ex-military aircraft?
I don't know, they probably were. He used most of his services were run by these. But he had a couple of Dakotas too, which were on the airport. His base was on the river, the Demerara River, which ran through Georgetown. And he had a ramp there which went down to the water and a sort of maintenance hangar where these aircraft were pulled backwards and forwards for maintenance. And the whole area was called the ramp. So, and Williams, Christian name, he was known as Art Williams. And Mrs. Williams, who was a sweet, slightly naive lady, she must have been to put up with Art for all those years, I think. Whenever I asked where he was, she'd say, oh, Art's down at the ramp. But I don't think she was aware of the other ramps which Art was involved in, which we'll come to later. So I never knew which ramp she was referring to, but I think it was the aeroplane one. Anyway, I got myself dressed up in my tropical suit and a suitcase, flew down to British Guiana eventually. I changed planes.
What were your orders when you sent off?
My orders were to case the joint out, so to speak, and make plans for where the troops would go, where they'd be put up, not billeted, but where they could be stationed, and get a plan for. So that everybody knew exactly where they, once they were ashore, they would know where to go.
Had you done a map study before you set off?
Well, I had a map with me there. I mean, I made a map. go on.
Had you been given any idea of how far the subversion of the police had gone? You know, what proportion that was reckoned were unreliable?
No, not really. Not really. Because I think it wasn't known. Mm. Because this is the problem. When subversion's going on, you sometimes don't always know how far it's penetrated into the institutions around the place. They knew it was going on, but apart from having all the constables up and saying, are you being subverted or not, they had all denied. But the very fact that he'd set up all these various committees and things, which he had got people to join.
Yes.
Now, they, many of them, probably were unaware of his intentions as to why they were in there. Then they got brainwashed. This was his idea, to get them into the pioneers and the peace committee and so forth. I mean, peace committee sounds quite innocuous when you look at it. But his intentions were otherwise, and people would say, oh, that's nice, I'll join the peace committee, I like peace. But didn't realise they were probably being slowly indoctrinated into attitudes of communism. So when I got off the plane, I went into customs. The first person I saw there was Teddy Jagan. Well, I couldn't quite, I sort of looked at him. He was busy sort of working away on the other side, talking to customs people. So I thought, well, this is stupid. He can't know I'm coming in. Even if he did, he wouldn't say anything, and probably is not worried anyway.
Had you ever met him?
No. So but I knew of him. I knew his picture. I knew
exactly. You knew him, but he did not know you.
No, he didn't know me, no. So I could have just been another European coming in. So having gone through customs, I was met by a couple of volunteers from the volunteer force who took me outside, put me in a car and drove off at high speed, drove into Georgetown. Of course, Atkinson Airfield is 15 miles outside Georgetown itself. Drove down a side turning where it was very dark, stopped, told me to get out, get into another car, which I did, lie down on the floor at the back, so I lay down on the floor at the back with my bag on top of me, and then drove off at high speed, and we eventually finished up at Art Williams's house, where I, having gone over the bumps and bangs on the floor there and got dirty and filthy, I wondered, what on earth am I doing? I'm supposed to be a civil engineer. Why all this sort of 007 stuff? But anyway, they thought they would do it, so I had to comply with
had
it.
Had you been informed that you were going to be met by volunteers?
Yes,
when you arrived?
Yes, I knew I was going to be met, yeah. But I didn't know they were going to go into these
cloak and dagger tactics,
which to my mind, afterwards, thinking about it, was quite unnecessary, really.
And also a dead giveaway if your
cover was
unbroken.
If somebody had opened the door and found me lying on the floor and they're sort of wondering what I was doing. I mean, they could have quite easily just picked me up and driven me there. Mm-hmm. I was the aviation engineer, so what was wrong?
Sounds like there was some crossing of wires.
There must have been somewhere, rather, or they yeah. Anyway, I got into Art's house, and then I spent, I can't remember how many days. Of course, I had to go around in his car, or his vehicles, and I made contact with the Commissioner of Police and the sub. Most of these things were done in the dark in the Arts place. And we gradually formulated a plan. And what we decided was we'd use the schools because they would be shut at that time. They all had playgrounds where vehicles could be parked, they had lavatories. They had running water, and some of them had even had kitchens. So it was possible, as far as I remember, to put one company into one school. And most of them were in sort of what you might call strategic positions all over the town. So the battalion wasn't all concentrated in one place. It was positioned around the town, so its presence was known to be there by everybody. There was also the airport, of course. We were going to use aircraft, which we did, to get one company out. One company went by air out to Atkinson Field, and one platoon was left out there to hold the airport when the occasion came.